Welcome, everyone. This is another podcast, Brighton Yoga Foundation's History of Yoga in Brighton and Hove series. And I'm delighted today to welcome Jim Tarrant. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Jim is well known to, I think, most people in the yoga community here in Brighton and Hove. So, Jim, just to start off, you're a Brighton boy, born and bred, I think, are you not?
No.
That's the first wrong question.
I was born in Windsor. And then I lived in Coulston in Surrey, and then I moved to Hailsham, and then eventually we moved to Hurst Pierpoint, and I went to school in Hassocks, which is near Brighton, and, you know, on the train line to London. And I went to the comprehensive school there, and then when I was 17, I moved into Brighton. But I, you know, during my teenage years, I was in and out of Brighton all the time because I had a girlfriend in Brighton, in Hove, actually.
Yeah, me too. I wasn't born in Brighton, but I grew up here as a teenager, so it felt like home. So, and how did you get into yoga? Everyone's always got an interesting story as to how they got into yoga. I hope you have. Is this another wrong question?
Fingers crossed. I hope I have too. It depends where you want to start, really. That you can see a clear interest growing from childhood, I suppose, because when I was a kid, I was really interested in sort of oriental things via sort of TV shows. You know, I used to watch Monkey and Shogun and all those kind of things. But there was always a mystical element that did something to me. You know, there were certain shows that had that sort of mystical element, even Sapphire and Steel, which was on the TV with Joanna Lumley and the other guy. Those things were, you know, they definitely lit something in me. And I used to like, when I went to churches and things, I always had a sort of, like, when there was no one else there, I'd always feel there was a sense of connection. And I loved those early movies about Jesus and anything sort of spiritual got my interest. And then I became a sort of fairly, from 14, I was a sort of fairly naughty teenager. And, you know.
You say fairly.
Fairly. Well, I started smoking. I got drunk for the first time. I had a girlfriend and all that. And worse. And so I had a tough time a bit with my parents, or they had a tough time with me, I should say. And I was really into music and art and that sort of thing. And so there was definitely a connection with wanting something other. And I felt a bit other in a way, or not quite part of the mainstream. Of course, yoga now is part of the mainstream. But then it wasn't so much. And then when I was interested in things like astronomy as well, which, you know, that kind of connects with that sort of widening of your perception and microscopes. You know, it's like, I want to see this very small, I want to see the very large, like in Patanjali Yoga Sutra, that they mentioned that the yogi has the power to see the very small or the very large, or the very small in the very large, which I could talk about, but I won't. So then when I was about 16, I started smoking a bit of pot and that kind of thing. You know, obviously kids don't do it, don't do drugs. And then getting interested in things like Sgt. Pepper's by the Beatles. I loved that album. So that had more Indian influence. Mm-hmm. So I went from the sort of interested in oriental things like Japanese, Chinese, but their connections with Buddhas. Between those ages, I started collecting. I used to go to Gerrard Street in London and go to Chinatown and just buy anything oriental I could, joss sticks and that sort of thing. And then when I got to 16, started smoking pot, discovered the Beatles, grew my hair long, had a beard, had a caftan.
And you're in Hurst Pierpoint at this stage.
I was Hurst Pierpoint at that stage, but, you know, it was getting difficult for my parents to have me there, entirely my fault. And when I was 17... I moved out to nearly 18. I moved out to Brighton and I'd left. I was at art college. I left art college without finishing and just moved to Brighton. And there I was living in a house in Hove at the time with a bunch of guys that had gone to Hurst Pierpoint College. So they were kind of posh boys, one was a biker and they were sort of smokers, pot smokers. And I sort of degenerated into a sort of fug of a lifestyle, you know. And I kind of was like, this isn't me, this doesn't feel right, you know, I don't want this to be the rest of my life. And then one of the guys there, Nick, he came in bright as buttons one day and he said he'd started yoga and meditation. And he was also a hit with the girls, and you know, that combination made me think, okay, mate, I don't want to be this sort of fuggish life, and I do want to be a hit with the girls. And so I sort of used his influence a little bit to start looking into, you know, just the basic things, looking at chakras and things like that, you know, in sort of New Agey books or books by Aleister Crowley, still quite hippie sort of in a way. And then I started working at lots of different jobs, gardening and so on. But my dad's a caterer, so I'd come from that. So I started working at Food for Friends eventually through a long trail of various other things. And at Food for Friends, a new chef started called Miranda, and she was really into yoga and meditation. She was 5 years older than me. And I thought she was pretty cool. She had dreadlocks, blonde dreadlocks, been to India several times. And I thought that was great. We became friends and eventually boyfriend and girlfriend. But she was very independent. She already knew what she wanted to do with her life. She wanted to emigrate to Australia. She wanted to do a yoga teacher training. And one day we were in... I started going to yoga classes with her, and I went to some Buddhist meditations at the Brighton Natural Health Centre as well. Mm-hmm. Then they used to have the monks from Chithurst come there, and once a week they'd do a puja. And I found it really challenging. I didn't like it, you know, meditating.
So was that the late 80s, that would have been?
It was... yeah, the late 80s. Yeah. You know, I was in 87, I was 17. Yeah, and, yeah. You know, so I was working there from about 88, 89, and then started to go to yoga in 1990, early 1990, and Buddhism and all that sort of thing. Mm. And I didn't like not being good in the classes. I used to sweat. I used to watch the clock, like, when will it end? But I did feel amazing afterwards, like my perception was clear. And it reminded me of what was good about the sort of Sergeant Pepper's kind of gym from before, you know, when I'd taken quite a lot of LSD as well. And I wanted to, you know, I knew that my way of seeing things was limiting. So that's kind of what the LSD was about. And the pot, it was like, expand your consciousness. But then after a while, that started to close my consciousness down. It didn't work. But after the yoga, I got the positive sides of the LSD or the magic mushrooms or whatever it was, that kind of super bright consciousness. And I was like, that's worth coming for. I'm going to come back for that. Anyway, there was a teacher there, Karuna Vira, as well, who doesn't teach any yoga anymore, but he's still in the Tri Ratna Buddhist order. And he was super inspiring. He was just a really bright guy. So I started going to his classes.
This was at Brighton Natural Health Centre?
No, this was at the old Brighton Buddhist Centre.
One before the one where they are now.
Yeah, because they're in Tichborne Street now, and they used to be in Park Crescent, which is where they're, I think it's called the White Eagle Lodge or something there now. So I used to go there and really inspired by him, because he was funny and he was kind and he was insightful. And at that time, the Tri Ratna Buddhist Order, as they're called now, hadn't, They went through a sort of scandal, as so many, you know, yoga meditation things do and have. They went through a sort of scandal. But then no one was aware of that at that time. So everyone that was involved was fresh-faced, excited, into it, not tainted at all. So there was that lovely energy. So I was going to his classes, Karuna Vira, and found him immensely inspiring. And he was very generous to me. And I sort of saw him as a sort of spiritual father, you know. He was older than me. So that was great. But I also went to the unemployment centre in Brighton. There was a teacher called Hazel who was about 80. So I don't think Hazel's around anymore.
Possibly not.
No, she dyed red hair. Mm-hmm. She was lovely, really lovely. And that's because my partner at the time used to, she used to cook for the unemployment centre.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Big pots of curry.
Yeah, lovely. And they did yoga there, did they? I know it's... near the resource centre now, isn't it? I can't remember what the street's called.
I don't know. It was like 20p for a class.
Was it?
Yeah, it was all subsidised, 20p for a class. She was cooking. Meals were like, I don't know, a pound, and you get a really big meal. really great. It was really great.
Is that what the scene was like then? Then a lot more sort of.
Yeah, I mean, it was very low key, the scene in Brighton. No, I reckon I knew everyone who taught yoga in Brighton, you know, at that time, or most of them. And it was mostly, this was before Ashtanga Vinyasa really hit Brighton. I remember seeing the first book about Ashtanga Vinyasa ever. And there was a book street on Bond Street, and it was a book by Liz Lark. And I walked past, and, you know, had a bold cover with Liz on the front, and I was like, okay, what's that? So I just kind of took it in. I think I bought the book, actually. And then I went to Australia, and Ashtanga Vinyasa was big in Australia.
Yes.
Big before it was here. And so there were lots of teachers there, Louise and other people who went on to become pretty well known in the Ashtanga world.
So around about 1990, I mean, there would have been Brighton Natural Health Centre, the Buddhist Centre.
Yeah.
Gary Carter hadn't opened up Natural Bodies by then.
I remember Natural Bodies opening in Bond Street when it was there.
That's right, yeah.
And I remember thinking, you know, who is Gary? Because I think I started teaching maybe 1 year before Gary, or you know, with sort of contemporaries. Although I've never met Gary, but of course I've you know, heard a lot about him, and I know people who know me and him, and, you know, have said, well, we should get you guys together.
Definitely, yes.
You know, and that would be lovely, you know, and we've got crossover areas, of course, you know. Yeah. So, yeah, so there wasn't many places. There were
absolutely.
So it was Iyengar yoga mostly, and some Shivananda yoga.
There was quite a lot of Iyengar at, Jenny Dedman and people like that were doing it at Brighton Natural Health Centre at the time.
Right? Yeah, Jenny Dedman and Louise Bittleston were both my Iyengar teachers, because I did my partner that I mentioned then, Miranda, at the time, she had this sort of plan to go and do a teacher training. We found I can't remember what the yoga magazine was, but there was an old, Yoga and Health magazine. And there was a guy on the front, I remember, who was in tree pose in Vrikshasana, but he had one of those things that you put plaster on with, and like a brick in the other hand, and he was a builder, like yoga's for builders as well. That was the kind of advert, And I think he had a yellow hat on as well. But in the back, there were lots of courses on yoga, you know, and mats, yoga mats. And then you didn't have yoga mats really. My first yoga mat was like a sort of toweling thing. I loved it though. I did love that yoga mat. And then we used to only be able to buy yoga stuff. There was a garage over in Hove and Shirley Drive. I don't think it was Raina Curtis, but or someone connected with Raina. Somebody there used to just have a garage full of blocks, and they were like a pound or something. And carpet underlay is what, before yoga mats, it was carpet underlay. That's where they came from. So we had that. But anyway, in the back of the magazine, there was an advert for a Patanjali Yoga Centre in Kathmandu, a teacher training course in April of 1992. So I'd been doing yoga a couple of years, and was I was into it by then. and it had replaced everything. You know, I used to be a smoker before that. I used to drink. And I used to go to yoga and then go to the pub afterwards and smoke less, you know, and drink less. And in the end, it was like half a cigarette and a half of Guinness. And then...
Oh, saving you money then.
It was saving me money. Lots of money.
I heard it here first.
Exactly. So that was... So I went to Kathmandu via India. We went to India first. I think we left in February or maybe January.
This is still with Miranda.
With Miranda,
Miranda the chef.
Yeah, Miranda the chef. Miranda Preston. She's now with a guy called Clive Sheridan, who's a well-known yoga teacher. And living in Byron Bay.
Yes.
And I've spoken to Clive a few times, but I've never met him directly. He's a lovely, lovely man. Yeah. I think he's from South London, somewhere along the river there.
No, he's very popular.
He is very popular. I mean, that's another whole load of stories. Yeah. It's connected another with podcast. Clive. Yeah, another podcast.
So that's how you got into teacher training there?
Yeah, I did a teacher training there at the Kathmandu Patanjali Yoga Centre. It was a month long, you know, classic month long teacher training. But I got so into it. But I arrived there with Jardia, so I was very skinny. And we did Shankar Prachalana, like a cleansing, yoga cleansing with salt water and all that. And it was full on. And I was already underweight massively. I was 7.5 stone because I'd got so ill from Jardia. And I'd gone to all various Indian doctors and they'd misprescribed me things. So when I got there and then I was doing this fast, I just couldn't get up. I couldn't get up or anything. So I cut the fast a little shorter than everyone else's. But I was really into the yoga and I'd get up earlier than everyone. It was me, Miranda, and some Canadian ladies who, because Sushil Bhattacharya's wife was Canadian who run the centre. So, yeah, so I did that. And then I went to Australia with Miranda to Byron Bay. And I started teaching. I was busking with the mandolin.
All right.
and I was picking fruit and I was teaching. I'd already taught a bit here, as I told you, in the garden at the Freshfield Mental Health Hospital in 1991.
I'd like to return to that, actually. That's quite interesting how that happened. But, yeah.
It is an interesting story, yeah. and then, you know, I hired the Scout Hut in Byron Bay and I taught there. There was a... Ashtanga Vinyasa was big in Australia then, really big. And I rented a room, which was in a room called the Epicenter, which is right on the beach. And two brothers who were the sons, I think, of some sugar manufacturers, Tate and Lyle or something, they had got this, it had been an old whaling abattoir. And they had one part, one of the brothers was into art, so he hired out these... And hardly rooms, they're concrete cells to artists. And then the other brother had this big hall where Hare Krishna meetings happen once a week and Ashtanga Vinyasa. I was skint, so I could never go to the Ashtanga Vinyasa. I used to hear it. I remember hearing them playing Sting and things, you know, at that time in the classes. There was a lot of music in the classes. But I went to the Krishna meetings and I stayed there and I taught in Byron Bay. In my own little way, and it was very exciting. I had 14 in a class once, and I, you know, didn't know what to do with myself. Then I came back after, you know, going through Thailand and places, and Miranda and I separated. Still in contact.
Let's go back to the Freshfield Road.
Yeah, how did that happen?
Well, it was through a friend who also used to teach yoga. Some people who are listening to this will remember Dave Ronchetti, and he taught yoga for quite a long time in Brighton and was a really lovely guy. But both of us were really good friends from Food for Friends. We used to work together, and he was a musician and so was I. He was a better musician than I, and a really great guy. But somehow, either him or me got this gig at a school playing guitars for their assembly at Lynchett Close, which was a learning difficulties school up the back of Hollingdean. And then through that, one of the teachers there knew the guy that was running the Freshfield Mental Health Hospital, Andrew, I think he was called, and went to speak to him there and you know, I said I'd be up for teaching art to people there. And so I did. And then I mentioned I was into yoga. And he said, well, why don't you know, teach a yoga class? So I did. And it was pretty challenging from the get-go because people had mental health problems. That's why they were there. But it was a good training, you know, in a way, because a lot of people come to yoga because they've got problems of various kinds. In fact, most people have problems.
Yeah, I think that's a good statement. Most people do have problems.
Yeah, it is. So that's kind of how that happened. And I stayed there until I went to do this teacher training in India, in Kathmandu.
Oh, okay. So this is before your teacher training. Mm-hmm. And then okay.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't insured and I wasn't qualified in any way.
Then that would happen now.
No, well, no, probably. But I mean, you know, maybe under the radar, but.
Yeah,
it's just further evidence, though, that people have been doing this sort of outreach type of stuff for long, long before Brighton Yoga Foundation got into it. People have been beavering away doing little classes like this and other stuff like that for a long time. Yeah. We are really building on that tradition rather than, you know, we're not trying to claim the credit for it all. You know, it's good that people have been doing it.
Well, it's a natural product of practicing yoga, isn't it? I mean, if you feel good, you know, you feel good enough to think about other people. And that's just natural. And also, the yoga breaks down that self-other paradigm. It breaks down all constructs eventually, so that compassion becomes a natural thing. It's not something you're doing to try and be nice. It's just, if you're hungry, you feed yourself. If someone else is hungry, you feed them. And so I think it's a byproduct of good yoga practice.
Obviously, get the government to do this. yoga, shouldn't we?
We really should.
Move on. So you've done your teacher training and you come back to the UK and you've done Iyengar yoga and you've done some Ashtanga.
I hadn't done Ashtanga then. I did a bit. I knew the primary series and I knew that they were doing it in that room in Byron Bay.
Yeah.
And I felt I'm missing out. Mm. So I did it myself. You know, I just said, okay, and I did the primary series. Mm. But I extended it. So I would end up doing 4 hours asana practice. They would do whatever, 2 hours, you know. And I do a lot. I was crazy for it. So I would do 2 to 4 hours of meditation, a couple of hours of pranayama, and then around four
sleep.
Hours of asana. No, sleeping. Sleep's for losers. So that was a lot of practice. Yeah.
You were driven.
I was driven. In Buddhist language, I'd say I was getting into a god realm. That is to say, my mental states were getting so temporarily purified by practice that I was high in a sense. You know, I was everything was very blissful, and you get this sort of magical feeling when prana flows through your body freely, and it starts to break down the self other thing. But you don't have insight. It's just because of practice, but you don't know why it's happened. So then you can become addicted to practice. And I think I did. I became addicted, like a drug addict, but to yoga practice. And that's because it made me feel magical, you know. Yeah. And there was a spiritual dimension to that, but it wasn't an insightful dimension because I didn't understand why it was that I felt better. I just felt better, you know, and more than better. I felt amazing. And I, you know, felt like a kid again in a good way.
And then, so when did Vajrasati begin? Because, I mean, it is one of the, in effect, traditions now in Brighton.
Yeah.
Very associated with yoga in Brighton. I mean, you've got the Buddhist tradition, you've got Ashtanga, you've got Iyengar. Mm. Not very much of a Shivananda tradition, actually, in Brighton, hardly in it all. But, you know, there are those things. And then suddenly there's this other one, which is uniquely initiated.
It's a Brighton baby, yeah.
Vajrasati. So how did all that happen? What's specific and unique to it?
Good questions. It happened by accident, as most good things do. I sometimes have the story that I'm not ambitious, but then I think I am, you know, in some way. And it depends what you mean by ambition, you know. It's like, I want to do something with my life. So I'd been practicing. I was in the Iyengar school for about 10 years, but I was with a bunch of Buddhists. And so we were sort of Iyengar plus Buddhism or Iyengar light or something, you know, because there was a culture in the Iyengar school of sort of firm disciplinarian kind of vibe, you know, the vibe, right? I mean, anyone who's done Iyengar yoga will know exactly. Mm-hmm. And there were softer teachers and harder teachers, and some and a lot of the time that was carbon copying of Iyengar. And I always thought, why copy his? You know, that's him, fine. Why do we have to copy that? And then I used to look at Iyengar every couple of years, something we were doing would change. So from Pune, you know, would be like, no, we don't do it like that anymore. So I'd be like, well, who's calling the shots and why? So I thought, okay, well, instead of following Iyengar as just waiting for the trickles of, you know, permission to come down, maybe I should follow his example in that he's being an innovator. He's listening, responding, experimenting, practicing, you know, as the greats have done. And I thought, okay, he's getting this information from practice, from listening, responding, from observing his students. But there are some problems, as I saw, in the institution of Iyengar yoga. Iyengar is an enormous hero of mine, and I've had some Iyengar teachers that have been incredible. But there was an institutionalized vibe there, which I think was making people teach like each other, sort of carbon copies of Iyengar in a way. Some teachers, not all.
Same in the Ashtanga tradition, I might add, but
On. I think it's no fault of either school. It's institutions. Mm. When something gets big enough, then it tends to be that it gets institutionalized, which means there's a sort of way of doing it that people are expected to do, which kind of cuts off their ability to be creative or empowered or actually observe what's really happening to their bodies. So instead of waiting for innovations, it's like, well, maybe we can do that. And then I immediately thought, well, if I'm going to make a school, I don't want the same mistake. I don't want to be a guy at the top, you know, who's going to, everyone's waiting for information. Yes. So I won't call it my name. That's the first thing. And at the time, you know, I mean, it's becoming a better known fact, but most of yoga, we can say, really has come from Buddhism. You know, the first Hatha Yoga text, the Amrita Siddhi, was a Buddhist text. The first time the word Hatha is ever used in India is in Buddhist texts, 17 Buddhist texts before the 10th century. The first time the word yoga is ever used is used in the Upanishads, in the Katha Upanishad, but it's used in reference, partly in reference to certain practices, but in some Upanishads, it's used to say what the Buddhists are doing. They're doing yoga. The Buddhists didn't use the word until we get into the Common Era. Anyway, I knew Buddhism was a big part of yoga and yoga a big part of Buddhism, and I'd been in the Buddhist, you know, world. So I wanted a Buddhist sort of name, Vajra. So Vajra, you know, is various things, but Vajra's also connect with what we might call Hinduism too, because it's the weapon of Indra, who is the king of the goddess in the Rig Veda. So that's good. It's a broad thing. And Indra originally had a Vajra, which was a mace, you know, and he used to knock the top of mountains off with it, as gods do. You know, Indra's a war god, you know, so that's his kind of vibe. And then later, when the Greek influence comes into India with Alexander and so on, he gradually adopts some Greek stuff. So he gets a thunderbolt, just like Zeus, you know, because he's the king of the gods. Zeus is the king of the gods. There's a merging happens. So Vajra becomes a thunderbolt. Later on in Tantric Buddhism, and we know Tantra obviously has an enormous, Shaiva Tantra, Buddhist Tantra, has an enormous input into what we now call yoga. The word Vajra comes up as the Vajrayana or the Tantrayana or Mantrayana. That's the Buddhist Tantric thing. But what it means, or what it means in that context, is immediate direct awareness. And so that made sense to me, you know, like there is an immediacy, isn't there, to yoga, where there's a sort of, in a way, it gets yourself out of the way. You know, doing, if you're an asana practitioner, it changes the patterns in your body for a bit. You know, if you don't do yoga for a while, you get cranky again, you know, but for a bit, it changes the patterns. And so when you're not sort of patterned, then you have an immediate experience of reality, which is interdependent. And that's liberating for a variety of reasons. So Vajra, like, sorry. And then Sati has a double meaning as well, because Sati in Sanskrit or Pali is a sort of is a Prakrit, so that's a sort of spoken vernacular form of Sanskrit, you could say. So there are many there were many Sanskrits originally, and there were many more Prakrits. Pali being the Prakrit that the Buddhists adopted and they wrote their early texts in. So in Pali, Sati is the word that in Sanskrit is Smriti, and the word that we now use for mindfulness. So mindfulness comes from that, and it means to recollect or to remember. So mindfulness and immediacy, direct knowledge was the kind of thing I wanted to point to. Let's have a direct experience for ourselves, so that otherwise it gets institutionalized. Otherwise we're reading books, remembering and going, okay, is this what I'm supposed to do? And when you start reading yoga texts, some of them contradict each other as well. Quite a lot of them do.
You know. So it's more empowering, you felt, for the individual, is that the...
Exactly. Yeah. More empowering for the individual. And without that empowerment, you get institutions. So I saw a school, I wanted a school where instead of there being one light and then, you know, lots of followers, as it were, being lit by one person's lamp, everyone gets a lamp.
Yeah.
You know, so it came about part just because a student asked me, a student applied for Iyengar teacher training. I gave them a letter of recommendation and they got turned down. And this student was really keen. And I thought, that's not fair. You know, it's not. And she'd been really practicing. So without thinking, being an Aries, are you an Aries, Davey?
No, Aquarius.
Aquarius, beautiful, nice sign.
Well done, Davey.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say mine.
You're not? Yeah. Is it one of the bad ones?
I don't know, actually. I'm a bit worried it might be.
I'm sure it isn't. If it is, you've given it a better name just by being yourself.
Yeah.
So that's the sort of the Buddhist connection, anyway, the Vajrasati and the mindfulness and the direct, and the fact that there's empowerment, but there's also, you know, the The Indian traditions are always valued mostly. It has the ways of knowing, the pramanas, ways of knowing things, you know. So in various different Indian schools, there are ways in which you can know whether something's true or not, whether it's through pratyaksha, direct knowledge, agama, a reliable source, or whether it's through inference. Different schools have different ways that you can say this is valid knowledge. But all of the schools of Indian philosophy all have direct knowledge. They diversify after that. Some of them have six. Vedantic schools have six ways of knowing things. Buddhists officially have two, but they really have three. Patanjali has three ways of knowing. Pratyaksha, Anumana, Agama, Pramanani, Patanjali says. So that's in direct knowledge, reliable sources, could be texts, could be teachers, and then inference. You know, you can know by the fact that, you know, there's a guitar in the room, that there's probably a musician in the house. Mm-hmm. So
this person...
Oh yes.
This one person is responsible for you having set up the school.
I hope you've
sort of recorded your thanks to this person
many times.
I've kept in touch.
Yeah, and I was very good friends with her husband before that as well. So immediately that I said yes to her, I then thought. It's no good having a school of one, is it?
No.
And what good is that to her? So then I just mentioned it on a yoga day I was teaching to somebody that I'm thinking of doing this. And then a friend of mine said, I'll host it. And she had a nice room in her house. So I started the first Vajrasati yoga teacher training with three people on the course. Mm-hmm. And that's how I sort of rolled. And gradually, as the years went by, I made it... a handbook for the teacher trainees, and then, of course, a website.
What year would this have been?
2000. So it's 22 years ago, yeah.
Were there any other teacher trainings going on, yoga teacher trainings?
Iyengar.
Specifically in Brighton?
None specifically born in Brighton, but Iyengar yoga was in Brighton. It was in Patcham. That's where I did it, with Louise Bittleston Jenny Bittleston and Louise Beglin.
Yes.
They were running it then, and we had Jean Maslin come, who's a very senior... teacher. Lots of senior teachers in the Iyengar school would come. Jean Maslin was great, actually. Louise and Jenny are really lovely as well.
It was one of the first teacher training modules, though, in Brighton.
Yeah, yeah.
I think.
I'm told.
Because now they're two a penny. They're all over. everyone makes their money out of the teacher training. They don't make it out of the classes in general these days.
Exactly.
So you've got it everywhere now, or every studio, 20-odd studios, nearly all of them doing teacher training. But this was quite one of the first.
I would say it was one of the first. I've been told it's one of the oldest schools of, yoga teacher training. Even in the country, if you don't count Shivananda and Iyengar and Ashtanga, those sort of seminal schools, then it's one of the first, and certainly the first in Brighton. There's no doubt about that.
And you didn't envisage, obviously, when all the best things start. You had no idea when this started that it's going to lead to. You've now got 50 odd teachers. I think it is nearly on your book.
120.
120.
Yeah,
I underestimated.
Wow.
I was counting them on the website. I obviously didn't count very well.
Yeah, well, they might not all be up there, but
120
teachers.
Is that international or is that in the UK?
London, Brighton. Some of them have moved abroad, New Zealand and places like that. You know.
When this one woman, you said she'd been rejected by, and you were thinking, oh, hang on.
It didn't seem fair.
It didn't seem fair.
Yeah.
And how formed was your idea at this stage? Was it kind of, you were at the stage of thinking, yes, I've got my manual in my mind and I've got a 12-week course worked out, or just let's try and see what happens?
It was let's try and see what happens. I had some principles that came to the fore quite early, and that we call those the tool belt. And they're things like, I realised there were methods that I applied to myself when I taught that helped me develop as a teacher, helped me... to find where my information was. So there are things like asking yourself how and why. You give an instruction and you say, oh, well, how are they going to do that? Don't just tell them to bring their leg here. Like, how? Well, by maybe, you know, imagining a bit of space in the hip, or maybe first of all bringing it back and forwards. And then why? You know, why are we doing that? You know, why do we have the heel lined up with the arch? Or why don't we turn the toes in? Exactly. You know, and one of the reasons to ask why is in case, you know, because students used to ask me sometimes and I'd be like, I don't know. And I thought, well, you know, I should challenge everything. Latterly, of course, more and more scholarships have been done on this, and we find that most of the postures that we think are ancient are not. Mm. And certainly the alignments are, Krishnamacharya and Iyengar, a lot of the alignment stuff.
Was wrong.
Yeah,
basically.
And a lot of it's wrong. Or not universally applicable. You know, you just can't.
Or dangerous to some. Some
of it's dangerous, yeah, exactly. And that's so then if you want to empower your teachers, you want to do the same for your students. You want to empower them to listen and respond. So that became another principle. Listen and respond so that the student didn't have to, you don't have to have your leg. If this feels better here, and then you have to go, what does better mean? You know, does it feel better because it's not challenging your patterns? Well, that's not necessarily a good thing. Yeah. But does it feel better in terms of, well, now I feel like there's some flow. Now I feel like I'm breathing. Now I feel like this is meditation. There's some ease in this, absorption in this.
So again, there's kind of empowerment model, isn't
all
it?
All about empowerement. Mm. Yeah. Because I see the flaws in Homo sapiens. I mean, we're beautiful and awful. But, if you have anyone at the isolated at the top of a school, they're open to corruption and just because they're a human being, and they get too much praise and they get, too much power.
Power corrupts.
It does.
Power corrupts, absolutely.
You see it again and again, and we've seen it in the yoga world and the meditation world. And I, it's done with everybody's doing it. It's not just the guru or who's responsible. It's the students for, putting them on the pedestal as well.
Definitely,
yeah.
So at any point were you thinking, I started my own yoga school. This is quite a power move. Should I?
Probably. I've got an ego. And several times I've sort of, you get a little high. The ego kind of makes you a little bit high, doesn't it? Sometimes you get a little bit, my ego is always popping up at his head. Even just going around on my electric scooter, sometimes I think, well, look at me on my scooter, sort of fancy myself. And that came up. But, any time there's another part of me that doesn't want to cause any harm to anyone. And I really like people as well. And so... So even though those little highs come, I always try to pitch the school. I always try to keep myself very, make sure no one could possibly project anything on me, by just being very obviously normal, flawed, I swear sometimes in classes on purpose when it's right, to keep it light. Yeah. I mean, it all depends who's there, because it's about making people feel at ease, whoever it is, and not making them get this idea that this Eastern mysticism that they can't get access to and you might give them a little morsel of it,
You want to tell them that you're just a yoga teacher and that's it.
That's it.
No big deal.
No
you're
big
just
deal.
Just a yoga teacher.
And I often frame it that we're practicing together. And I can learn from them, and I do learn from students, that course, someone moves their body and like, that's interesting, why did you do that? And they're like, oh, my knee feels better. Great, I'll try that. And that's how Vajrasati forms, by listening and responding to your own body and going, well, this feels better for me. Okay, that's valid. Feels better for me. So that's a valid form of affirmation. And then seeing, offering it to people. This feels valid for me. You could try it. May or may not work. Recollect the caveats, like it's not just that my leg's over here, but I'm also, not putting my foot on the gas too hard, or I'm breathing more freely, or whatever. But then observing how many students, and if you see everybody over a number of years all getting on with that instruction, you might incorporate that permanently. And like, I've seen everyone over years getting on with this instruction, so I'll incorporate it. Or I've only seen some people, so I'll say some of you might find this useful, some of you won't. Or just 1 in 100, you might say. Well, most of you won't find this useful, but if you want to try it, you can.
Yeah. Conscious of time.
Oh, yeah.
So, what now? What next for? Because this has been going for 20-odd years, and 120 students. Quite a lot of people actually in Brighton. I was looking through the list. I thought, I know them.
Yeah.
I mean, there's Tammy, works for us.
Exactly.
Pablo, and a lot of people who I know
that's
well.
Right.
All sorts of people I didn't realise had come through your team.
Not everyone puts the name Vajrasati up, much to my protestations. Yeah,
so,
there's
so what next now?
I want to spread.
Where
it,
do you want to go now?
Yeah, or? I want more people in the school to rise up into positions of responsibility. I want other people to. So I run the school with Kadeem Morecambe, who's my partner and an amazing yoga teacher. And so that's been great. And that was a big thing for me to let go. You know, when Kadeem first came in and helped 7 or 8 years ago, I'd been doing it on my own. And so it was a big deal for me to let the reins go. But I want to do that more and more. I see within the school maturation. It takes a long time for people to become mature teachers. But it's been going long enough that we've got some, you know, Sarah Palethorpe, Leonie Taylor, and lots of mature people rising up in the school. And I just want to give them the more and more power. And I want to do less in a way of some things and more of others. You know, I'm writing 4 books at the moment, which is too many to write at once, but I'm writing 4. I've finished 2, yoga books, obviously. And so I want to put time into that. I want to put time into workshops. I'd like to do more on extra courses for teachers about yoga philosophy, more subtle levels of yoga practice, things that, you know, I probably, you know, chewed the ear of the listener off on this podcast already. But there's I'm bursting full of enthusiasm and things I want to share. So, yeah, keep going with the teacher training, see it grow as a school that can exist without me. That's my ambition.
And that's part of your, again, I keep coming back to this empowerment, but that is part of it, isn't it? That,
I just want to see it, you know, just running itself. And then I can sort of be part of it.
Yeah.
You know, and that's happened a couple of times when I felt like, oh, I'm part of this fellowship.
Yeah.
And I want to extend that fellowship wider as well. You know, we're obviously at the Brighton Yoga Festival, and I've said to people, we've got a stall there, and I've said, part of our mission there, if you're on the stall, is to recognise the wider family of everyone in Brighton who's a yogi, not to go, there's Vajrasati yoga and then this yoga and that yoga. We're a family, and I think it's lovely to recognise that, you know. And, you know, as we've been talking, I've been seeing you sort of affirming things that we both obviously think that have come to individually. And I'm sure lots of people have come to certain conclusions by themselves. And we've all got common ground like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's kind of it.
So just finally, any final sort of observations on the community? I mean, there are 800 teachers, we think, in Brighton, right. Something like that, which is one for every 220 adults.
Right.
Which we're pretty sure is the highest concentration per head of anywhere in the country, if not Europe.
I'm sure of it.
You know, we've got 20 yoga studios, depending on how you define yoga studios. I mean, this is a different landscape to what it was 20 odd years ago.
So different.
So any observations on that? Any thoughts?
Well, I think, yeah, the yoga world's changed, you know, and some of the values have changed, and some for the better and some for the worse, you know. So some for the better are things like, you know, empowerment and, you know, not sexual misconduct's been brought up and where it needs to be brought up and, you know, appropriate adjustment. All that's really positive. Equality generally across the board, whether it be respecting the cultures that we bring these things from, all that's been a really positive thing in the yoga world. But there's also part of the yoga world, which I guess maybe is just, you could call it entry level yoga, I suppose, which has become, yoga's become much more across the board. It's not just for people who are interested in a sort of spiritual path necessarily. And it's not just for people who might see themselves as a bit counterculture in a way. It's quite mainstream. Mm-hmm. And that's no bad thing. That's a good thing. But I think there's within that, there's a risk of it getting sort of dumbed down and the om being just a decorative thing that, you know, instead of actually having a meaning. And so I'm sort of, I'm a traditionalist and modernist at the same time. You know, I want it's like a stream that comes from the tradition but continues through into our current time. And so that's how I see it. But I try not to get too involved with trends. You know, you see trends come and go in the yoga world, and, you know, there are various trends that people get involved in that are sort of, you know, and this isn't any kind of criticism, but there are cacao ceremonies and people bathing in ice water and all that. And that's seems like they're a great thing. I mean, who doesn't like chocolate and, you know, I have a cold shower, you know, in the morning. So that's, you know, but there's lots of things that come and they come and some of them come and go. So I try not to get involved with too much gong baths or all that, you know, which again, I'm sure is lovely. But I don't, you know, I kind of keep myself to myself a little bit in some ways, in a sort of, it's not quite a cocoon, but something like that. But you know, I'm an optimist too. And I think the world has to change. And I think it, well, because it has to, I hope it is.
Yes.
Well, thank you, Jim. And on behalf of your 120 teachers and all the other people that they've taught, thank you for your contribution to building up the Brighton Yoga community to make it part of what it is, you know, because I don't think the people who are the early pioneers of this get enough thanks. So on behalf of everybody, thank you. And thank you for doing this interview with us. And we'll be doing another interview very shortly. So that's the end. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much.